Thanks, Barry. My name is Dave Huggins. I'm a soil scientist with the USDA ARS in Pullman, Washington, and it's good to see you all here this afternoon. Thanks for coming. And I see a number of my colleagues that have contributed greatly to the kinds of data I'll be showing over the years. So conveniently, Bill Schillinger is right here in the front row. He can jump up and answer some questions as we go along. And I see several others that I'll point out perhaps along the way as we get to different parts of this talk. What I'm going to be talking about is some of the experiences and the current situation in kind of the dryland northwest. And what I've shown here are some of the major land resource areas that the NRCS has that include the kind of in orange. I think I've got a little kind of an orangish color. This is the Columbia Basin where a lot of irrigated crops are grown. I'm not going to be talking about those today. And then you kind of get over here into the Columbia Plateau, where some of our grain fallow systems are, and then the Palouse and Nez Perce prairies here, and a little bit of the northern Rocky Mountains, too. But anyway, precipitation-wise, we're in the rain shadow of the Cascades over here in the western part of this region, about 150 millimeters of rain annually per year. And Bill has reported on some of the lowest some of the wheat production in some of the lowest rainfall areas in the world in these locations. And then as we go across this region, we have a tremendous gradient in terms of precipitation. And by the time we get over here in the northern parts of Idaho and up on the Camas Prairie, we're over 700 millimeters per year. So farming literally changes foot by foot as we go across this whole region. It's incredibly, well, in my way of thinking, incredibly diverse in terms of the different practices that are used to grow crops in this area. A lot of the research that I'm going to be talking about has been continued on most recently by REACH, which is Regional Approaches to Climate Change. This is a NIFA-funded CAP project, directed towards climate change, but looking at, in particular, our cereal or wheat-based kinds of cropping systems in the Inland Pacific Northwest. And Bill Pan, who many of you might know, heads up the cropping systems portion of this project, and the mitigation and adaptation strategies that we're looking at from a cropping system perspective are nitrogen management, diversity, and diversifying and intensifying cropping systems, reduced tillage, direct seed systems, and organic amendment recycling. And I'm going to draw from some of the diversification and intensification work that's been going on. But I'm going to take a little tangent at first, and this is some work that I've been working on in the last couple of years. And many of you are probably familiar with agroecoregions or zones, and they're zones or regions that are defined by major biophysical drivers for the most part. For example, climate, geology, physiography, soil, native plant communities. Examples, the ecoregions of the US EPA, the NEON, that is the National Ecological Observatory Network domains, hydrologic units, USGS, major land resource areas that I mentioned, NRCS, and around the Pacific Northwest, Douglas and co-workers put together agronomic zones. Now, there's some strengths with respect to this land use classification. The zones tend to integrate relatively stable data layers of biophysical drivers, but that's also a weakness when you're trying to look at dynamics over time. And the weaknesses then are the boundaries stay relatively static through time. And there's always a question about the weighting of these biophysical drivers. Often statistical or weight of evidence kinds of analyses are used to say, okay, what constitutes a particular major land resource area. And also, there's always a question that some, including myself, have in terms of their relevancy with respect to managed ecosystems, because the zones often contain very diverse land uses and management practices. So we had one objective to try to develop what I'm calling dynamic agroecological classes. And the purpose of some of this was to establish a land use baseline and the capacity to evaluate shifts in land use cover over time. In other words, diversification and intensification kinds of practices. The dryland cropping system is kind of the target of this, grain fallow, annual crop fallow transition, and annual cropping. And also, if we're able to do this, we can develop a geospatial land use context for research, education, and outreach activities. So many of you may be familiar with the NATS, the National Agricultural Statistical Service cropland data layer. Since 2007, this has been produced across all of the United States. And you can see some of the classification of the land used in cover comprised of small pixels. The little brown ones there happen to be winter wheat. Currently, these are in a 30-meter pixel size, so there's literally hundreds of thousands of these pixels that can be looked at. And again, it's produced every year. And, our approach was to assume that agricultural systems and land uses have emerged as a consequence of biophysical and social economic drivers. So we're changing this whole classification system on its head from the standpoint of the past. We're saying we really don't know what the drivers are, but if we can choose a few carefully selected criteria, then we may be able to see how different kinds of AECs in this case change over time, and we can start to pose some hypotheses as well. So what we did was defined our major AECs as annual cropping, simply as less than 10% fallow. We did go through a process to kind of predict or to come up with these percentages. I won't go through that now, but I think you'll get the gist of things. Annual crop fallow transition, 10 to 40% fallow, and then grain fallow as greater than 40% fallow. So we're using one criteria, fallow, and its proportion to help basically as a criteria to classify these major land use areas. And what we do is we go to a pixel, as you might imagine, a 30-meter pixel may lie in a fallow location or some other. What we do is we start to use the pixels around it to describe, to figure out what the proportion of fallow is for a particular area. We've gone through an optimization procedure to see, well, what size of a window do we need to place over this to basically be able to derive what kind of cropping system this is. And so one of the strengths of this is it can be done every year. So you can go out and actually define your AECs. You can see what kinds of shifts you may have had from year to year. This is an example of 2007 and 2009. And in this case, the blue is our annual cropping area in both cases. The yellow here is the annual crop fallow transition location. The brown is the grain fallow location, and then this aquamarine or whatever that is, the irrigated, and I'm not talking about today. But here, if you look at these maps, you can see some subtle differences from year to year. You can also look at the pixel composition itself to see what kinds of crops are actually in these areas as well. So you can start to get an idea not only how much is in the annual crop region in an area and how that changes, but you can also see its components from the standpoint of the crops that are actually grown and track those as well. Oh, the other thing you could do is that now that you have this type of a situation, you can start to pose hypotheses. Why do we get these dynamics over time? Is it a change in economics, the price of nitrogen or the price of a commodity? Or is it a weather event, a wet spring, et cetera, that drives some of the land use choices that we have in these different areas? And so this becomes a powerful tool to kind of not only document what's going on from the standpoint of growers and their decisions with respect to land use, but it also gives you a powerful base to start to pose different kinds of hypotheses in terms of why they're making those kinds of decisions. So here's what that looks like a little bit from the standpoint of annual cropping and the annual crop fallow transition and then the grain fallow. And here you see, here's the key going from winter wheat down to fallow. Surprisingly, in 2000, this is for 2007, 49% in the annual cropping was winter wheat. Now, if you look at some of the prices back then for alternative crops, you recognize, well, the farmers were growing winter wheat for a reason. They were making much money on the other crops. So from that standpoint, and I'm generalizing the soil scientist, but anyway, I was surprised to see, well, I was thinking, oh, this is a three-year rotation that people use in this area. Well, farmers don't really use rotations. They follow some of the commodity prices, and they're growing winter wheat as often as they can. Spring wheat was the next on the list in terms of 14%, 10% spring barley, and then these other pie-shaped regions are the pulse crops, as we call them, lentils, pea, and garbanzo beans, or chickpea. A little slice of canola, and there's a 3% fallow that's there. Now, if you go over to the annual Crapella transition, it's about, again, about 500,000 hectares in terms of, and I forgot to mention the mean annual precip that's here, 570. This is, again, the mean annual, not the range. And then for the annual Crapella, we're drier, 450 millimeters, 46% winter wheat, 14% spring wheat. But you can see what's dropped out, and then the barley is here, almost about the same percentage. But what's dropped out are all these pulse crops. So they've been replaced completely by fallow, so 28% fallow. And then, so as we got drier, that's dropped out as a component then of these cropping systems. And then as we go to grain fallow, our biggest group area-wise, over a million hectares, mean annual precip of 300 millimeters, but 47% of winter wheat, 44% fallow, a little bit of spring wheat, mostly grown to as we get winter kill, et cetera, on some of our winter wheat acreage. So I was going to go through some of these different AECs then and kind of discuss some of the current research as well, some of the issues that we have. As was mentioned previously, follow the water. The water is really critical in all of this. Bobby Stewart, thank you. And we rely on stored soil water here in the Pacific Northwest, or there in the Pacific Northwest, because about 60 to 70% of our precipitation occurs during the wintertime. And often, you know, during the summer months when crops are ripening, July, August, these are very, very hot, dry months. And in fact, not much effective precipitation actually gets driven. And I've gone through 3 months at a time, June, July, August, with no precipitation. We still have fabulous crops. If we had good, because we have deep soils, we have good capacity to store moisture in these soils. And so we rely on stored moisture. There are still loam, lush soils. So from that standpoint, it's a wonderful resource. The other issue, particularly in the grain fallow, is seed zone water. So this has been a characteristic of grain fallow systems for quite a while, where we basically have to, in order to plant winter wheat towards the end of August and early September, we have to be able to plant a seed into and have it germinate and emerge into water. And if you haven't had rain for 2 months, one of the goals of the management systems there is to, well, how do we achieve it so that we can plant our winter wheat early? And if we don't get it established and growing early on, then we face some real yield penalties, upwards of 30% or more. We have to wait for it to rain and then for things to come along. The rains don't come until later on in the fall. And that comprises then a tremendous risk and yield a decrease. So from that standpoint, creating this seed zone water has been extremely important. And the picture to the right is the wind erosion slide. Not too long ago, 2009, visibility dropped to zero in parts of eastern Washington on October 4th. Extremely, when we had this, what's called a dust mulch, which is very just powdered soil that serves as a capillary barrier for water to move out of. The water's maintained a little bit below, maybe 4 or 5 or deeper, actually, inches deep. You've got to be able to hit that with your planting equipment. But this powdered mulch is extremely susceptible to wind erosion, and it's a silt loam. It has a lot of fine dust-sized particles that can go and be suspended. This is a satellite image from that NASA provided, a satellite image. Yeah. So anyway, other issues, winter annual grassy weeds, theme perhaps in this conference in dryland areas, feral rye, downy broom, jointed goat grass, and other research, prior research, and not only like Bill Schillinger and Frank Young, but also kind of quantified from an economic perspective from Doug Young, is that our experiences with spring crops have not been very economical. So this hasn't tended to be a very viable option in these grain fallow areas. And here's some more that speaks to that from the standpoint of alternatives to conventional wheat fallow. This is from Morrow, Oregon, 230 millimeter rainfall, 5 or 6 year study with seven different cropping systems. And with, okay, what can we do from the standpoint of either intensifying or at least getting to some sort of conservation tillage-based types of systems? And here we have chemical fallow winter wheat as compared to conventional fallow winter wheat. So tier systems, they were the most profitable. The chem fallow winter wheat, spring barley, is again, an intensification, reduced fallow by a little bit. But you can see, although not statistically different, we're starting to get into the negative profit zone. A continuous spring wheat, winter wheat, winter pea, continuous spring barley, continuous winter wheat, all in the red from the standpoint of economics. So a lot of the strategies right now are trying to look at alternative winter crops to try to diversify the rotations. And in this case, we're trying to find alternatives to this section, the winter wheat portion of the rotation. So winter triticale, winter canola, winter pea, facultative wheat are all current ongoing experiments to try to see if we can put something into this location, this pie shape, in addition to winter wheat. And some of the equipment that's been used to do that, I won't talk a lot about that, are stripper headers, basically to maintain higher, taller amounts of residue after harvest as compared to a cutter bar. And we've seen some interesting data with respect to how that impacts wind speed and soil water temperature regimes. Again, getting back to a conservation type of situation and how that may in turn help some of the establishment of these different winter crops. And then a new drill design that Bill has worked quite a bit on, and basically one that allows more clearance from the standpoint of residues and still being able to get down and plant winter wheat fairly deep, but having enough clearance to also clear quite a bit of residues. You can talk to Bill about that. He knows a lot more about that than I. So more of Bill's research is looking at winter triticale, and this is quite interesting to me on several fronts. So early planted winter triticale produced an average of 18% greater grain yield than early planted winter wheat. And then late planted winter triticale produced equal grain yield as early planted winter wheat at Ritzville. This starts to shed a light that, oh, there may be some alternative crops that don't need to be established at the end of August, early September, where we have to have this dust mulch, et cetera. And if we're able to open that door up, then from that standpoint, that starts to give us a lot more flexibility to bring in more conservation-based types of systems. You can also start thinking about perhaps the introduction of cover crops that, okay, if we're not concerned about seed zone moisture or maintaining it anymore in late August, early September, can we bring in a cover crop that will actually use some of that, perhaps change some of the efficiencies in terms of how water stored? Our fallow systems are notoriously inefficient from that perspective, and not have to worry about getting winter wheat established in early September, late August. And then if we can do that, then that may open the door, in other words, towards different kinds of thinking in terms of various kinds of cropping systems. The rise of the canola industry is quite a story in and of itself. Karen Sowers in the audience today, she worked quite a bit with this with Dr. Bill Pan. And as part of the Washington Biofuels Cropping Systems team, this is a team that was started up in 2007. The Washington legislature was quite interested in trying to promote some of the biofuel industry, and we got on board, and it's been a fun ride. So this is some research, in this case, from Frank Young and Lauren Young, not related, winter canola establishment, a heavy winter triticale stubble. Here they're using a stripper header, again, that's pictured there on the left, and to reduce soil temperature and wind speed. And you can see some data from the standpoint of cutting the residue high and leaving it that way as compared to a cutter bar, or stripping it, I should say, as compared to a cutter bar lends itself then to some moisture conservation and a little bit better establishment from the standpoint of winter canola. We're trying to establish again this winter canola during it's still under debate when we should be establishing it during the summer months, but again, a very dry period of the year for the most part, moisture conservation being important. Some of Bill's work, again, has been, okay, can we plant and establish winter canola when we do have moisture? What about planting winter canola earlier on in June and July when we actually could find seed zone moisture for this small seeded crop. And maybe we can get some establishment then. Of course, there's some trade-offs there in terms of what might happen to that canola if it does get established. But traditionally, winter canola in many parts of, well, in Kansas and other areas, and traditionally in this part of the world, not the dry land, but in Idaho where it was grown more traditionally, the mid-August type of planting period was pretty much what we kind of targeted. But in mid-August, it's hard to find seed zone moisture for canola. So this has been a little bit of, well, hence the winter triticale and trying to save some seed zone moisture, but also trying to play with some of the planting dates. And of course, Bill has a nice slide here from the standpoint of basically the baseline in terms of the soil water going down. Here is the earlier planted winter canola. We've consumed some consumptive use of some of the water, quite a bit of the water actually there. And then here you can see where we haven't, where we seeded later and we haven't consumed quite so much water. So we can produce some fairly. Here's the June 10th versus a June 26th seeding, a little bit smaller here as you can see. The plants are getting big already here. And so there's some trade-offs. We don't know what some of the soil water depletion might do from the standpoint of stress, and also water is critical for us. So do we use too much of it too early? Okay, so this is not a cover crop study on your left. This is up near the Okanagan region, some of Frank Young's work, and it's feral rye in winter canola field. And feral rye, you've got a two-year rotation, winter wheat, fallow. Some of these winter annual grasses are tough to manage under those kinds of circumstances. And here we have Roundup Ready canola. So after a fall glyphosate application, it looks kind of like this. And of course, John Kierkegaard will tell us, well, if it works that good, you better not do it anymore. Because, my gosh, it's going to end up that we're going to be abusing some of these kinds of herbicides, develop herbicide resistance, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's definitely a fear that we have, but this looks kind of like a silver bullet for a while from the standpoint of growers looking at a very serious feral rye with, you know, consequences from the standpoint of dockage, et cetera, for your winter wheat. To shift over to the annual cropping area, this is a little steeper than in some other locations. There's some unique agricultural challenges. They're mentioning farmers developing equipment. Well, this is not surprisingly where some of the first hillside combine prototypes were developed. Imagine that. But steep slopes combined with very high yield still. I mean, look at the stubble that this farmer's cutting here on some very, very high sloping ground. In fact, this region brags that we produce, you know, the most winter wheat per acre than any place in the world. And I would argue, my gosh, you also have the most acres per acre than any place in the world. So it's quite actually a system. There's a lot. So post-harvest residues loads are quite high. And this has been a real barrier for many of the no-till kinds of operations that have to follow this. If you're going to plant directly into this type of environment, this is tough. This is tough for equipment. It's tough to place things. Well, there's been a lot of innovation by farmers in this area. Some are making it a successful run of it, but this has not been an easy type of nut to crack. So from that standpoint, and of course, many of the equipment that is designed by things that are green, people that are green and red, you know, they don't always fit these slopes. And so the first thing that farmers do is bring that equipment into their shops. They cut it all up. They redesign it. And this is the way things go and how progress is made in this area. So some of the things that we've worked on is, well, if winter wheat stubble produces so much stubble as a barrier to no-tillage, what kinds of crops might do well in that type of an environment? I can tell you that it's tough with spring wheat, which is one of the crops that often follows winter wheat. Spring wheat comes in. Spring wheat, you know, it does not like cool. Well, it's not going to be optimal for it when it's cold and wet. And you want to plant it as early as you can in order to avoid some of the heat stresses that you've got going on. So from that standpoint, spring canola is something that loves residue. In fact, most of the canolas really like, they do well under high residue situations. That can aid some of the weed management as well, as we talked about. And we've also seen that early seeding really tends to boost some of the yields in the annual cropping area. And if you look at tracking the canola production, going back to those maps you can produce now, if you have AECs, you can see the canola production throughout time here. And most of the increases have come from both the annual cropping and the grain fallow area, and a little bit from the annual crop transition. Winter pea and fallow systems, another diversification strategy. This is in Ritzville, 280 to 330 millimeters. Good winter hardiness in Austrian winter pea in this case. It could be a fit when prices are good. And again, you've got a large seeded crop in this case. You can plant this a little bit deeper. Maybe that seed dome moisture isn't quite, well, it's still critical, but you may be able to go for it from the standpoint of an Austrian winter pea. And replacing fallow and the shift to Pendleton, 430 millimeters, replacing fallow with spring pea. And in this case, from Steve Machado's work, a winter wheat yield was similar after fallow or pea. Definitely a location where intensification can take place. As we know, peas don't use as much water as many other crops, and so this seems to be a fit there. Back to the annual cropping in terms of crop net returns, and the green part of the farm there is where winter wheat is grown, and this is again some of the reasons why some of these alternative crops have not. That's the red part, is we're in the red. Spring wheat just breaking even. But along came garbanzo beans, chickpeas, and my gosh, for the first time in my career anyway there, in 2009, the returns over costs for garbs beat winter wheat. I said, whoa, there is now an alternative crop that actually pays for itself. Tremendous. And sure enough, we've seen, and that wasn't true just for garbs, it was true for other, some of the other grain legumes. The prices were good for a while. Here's tracking some of the grain legumes, and again, you can see some of the upward trends. Mostly all in the annual cropping area, little bumps over here in our other two zones, but not much. I'll tell you the story about this dip here, but I don't think I've got time. Another thing that you can think about from the standpoint of AC is you can use diversity indices. So you can sit there and say, well, I have a quantitative means to go assess these AECs. How is diversity changing over time? If anybody's familiar with these, if you've got only one crop, your Shannon's diversity would be zero. So we're not very good in terms of diversity, but there are kind of trends that things might be going up a little bit. But you can also look at, whoa, you could also look at fallow. How much fallow do we have over the whole in each region or over the whole region? And from that standpoint, we can see that fallow has held steady. And in fact, if anything, we see some little increases over this short time period that we can assess it. But it's kind of steady, which is saying that when we've got this diversity change, we're really not replacing fallow. We're replacing other crops out in the system itself. And another fun thing that we've done is to try to use these we've gone through with a discriminant analysis, and we've basically predicted what class we have based on a few bioclimatic variables. So we could take precipitation, growing degree days, and precipitation during a few of the spring months, and we can basically classify these systems, predict where they are geospatially with those three variables with only 10% error. And so that lends itself then to projection from climate change models. And so what you see here with the question mark is a representative concentration pathways 4.5 for the years 2056, and then for RCP 8.5. And you can see the scary thing is, if you believe this, and I'm not sure I do yet, you can go to Harsim Rancour's poster. It's right after this. And you can see that there's less annual cropping in these scenarios being predicted by this particular approach. And that starts to, and what's increasing, though, well, the grain fallow is kind of staying fairly stable in terms of acreage, but what's increasing is this intermediate crop fallow transition zone, which is telling me, oh my gosh, is there going to be more pressure on our annual cropping? And of course, that has implications with respect to erosion and other kinds of factors that, from a soil scientist perspective, I'm very concerned about. And Perry, how much time do I have? Like two, minus two? 30 seconds, all right. So current, future, some other efforts, too, are incorporating process-oriented crop modeling into all of this, working with Claudio Stockel And my gosh, it's time to bring these models to the farm to support decision aids, ecosystem services. We can now model across this whole region, and we should be, from the standpoint of alternative crops, to try to project what different kinds of yields might be, given the current and past weather events and climate, and we'll be working hard on that. And I wanted to mention, like Mark did as well, the long-term agro-ecosystem research. And this is basically the footprint for that research. We tend to really support long-term research in the area. So I'm going to look forward to working with a number of folks throughout this region as this rolls forward. So thanks.